So if you have your Bible, if you want to turn to Genesis chapter 19, we're going to pick up where we were. So just to refresh our memories as to what's going on here, we're dealing with the story of Abraham. And in the last chapter, as Abraham was hanging out there at his tent, all of a sudden three guys came up to visit him. And in the process of that visit with them, we came to a realization that this was a visitation from the Lord. The Lord had come with two of his angels, was talking with Abraham and was telling him about how he was going to have a son, and that Sarah, his wife, was going to be the mother of this son. And so that was the account, remember, where Sarah had even laughed as she was listening in the tent, and when she heard that she was going to have a child, she'd been barren all her life, and now she was really old, and now she's going to have a child, and she laughed in her heart. And God said to Abraham, why did she laugh? And, you know, of course, she denied it and all. Well, remember, as the story unfolded there, the three angels, or the Lord and the two angels, rather, went out, and two angels left and headed off towards Sodom. They're standing on an area where they're able to look out over the plains there where the city of Sodom was. And the Lord told Abraham that he's going to go in and destroy Sodom because of their wickedness. And remember, Abraham was fairly well-wigged at this concept, and he started bargaining with God, saying, you know, would you destroy them if you could find 50 righteous guys there? And God said, no, I won't destroy them if I can find 50. And remember, he kept on going with it, 50, 40, how about 30 or 20 or 10? And the Lord even bargained it all the way down, said, I won't destroy Sodom if we can find 10 righteous people there. So this is the follow-up from that. The camera faded out, and now it comes back, and it's the follow-up story that we have here. And in this, we're going to see an illustration, really, for us. We're going to see the high price of living a compromised Christian life. It's a tragic passage in many ways. And as we read this account, we're going to look at Lot, who, remember, Lot had a falling out with Abraham a while back because their flocks were getting in each other's way. And so Abraham said to Lot, you know, you decide where you want to go, and you go ahead and go there. And so Lot chose the best place for himself, and he took off towards the plains of Sodom because it was so nice down there. And so we look at Lot, you know, in a lot of ways we see someone who's been a very compromising individual. He's been very self-oriented, and it's almost hard to reconcile Peter's words in 2 Peter 2:7 when he talks about Lot and how it says in there that even righteous Lot was vexed within himself or was distressed in himself at the sinfulness of Sodom. So Peter, you know, is referring to Lot as a righteous man. He's referring to him as one who is a believer, one who's in the confines of the kingdom of God. And yet, as we read this, you know, that can be a little bit perplexing when we see how he behaves here and how he acts. But what we do see is that this behavior and his activity and his choices are not without penalty, are not done in impunity. In other words, he can make choices. He's got that freedom. He can make determinations about what he wants to do, but there's a high price tag that comes with it. And this is what we see, the consequences of living in a way that isn't harmonious with the relationship that we have with God, harmonious with even the light that has been given. So let's begin here in chapter 19 of Genesis. Let's read verses 1 through 3. It says, the two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face on the ground. My lords, he said, please turn aside your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night, and then go on your way early in the morning. No, they answered, we will spend the night in the square. But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him, and they entered his house. And he prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. All right. You realize something here? It was right at the very beginning of this. But you realize where it says Lot is? Lot is sitting in the gateway of the city. What we have witnessed here in Lot's story is a progressive slide. When he began his little sojourn in this area here, remember when he was with Abraham and they were looking at the various places where they could go And Abraham said to Lot, you choose which way you want to go. And he looked down there, and it looked pleasing down there. So he said he went and camped near the city. And then later on, remember, he's already in with the city, because when the battles erupt between those five kingdoms, and his family and all is carried away because they're associated with Sodom. And so then later on it says he's living in the city, and now here we see that he's sitting in the seat or the gateway of the city. And this was a position. This wasn't just him hanging out, sitting there like a tramp in the gateway of the city or whatever. He is there, and when they say that he's sitting in the gate of the city, it means in actuality that he is holding a position of authority or respect among the people of Sodom. It's equivalent to being, you know, like the mayor. So here he is, instead of just camping near the place or whatever, he's actually moved in. He is a part of the city. He's actually someone who's a respected leader or elder within the town. And it's probably because of the fame of Abraham. Remember when Lot was carried away, Abraham got his commandos together and they went out and they got Lot and all of his possessions back, and all the possessions of Sodom and stuff. So the fame of that, I'm sure, carried a lot of weight with the people of Sodom, and so they looked very favorably, I'm sure, on Lot because of Abraham. Here is Lot sitting in the gate of the city, and it's interesting to note that he shows the same kind of hospitality that Abraham showed when these guys showed up at his tent. Remember, Abraham did the same thing, bowed down low and invited them in and wanted to give them food, et cetera, like that. And Lot's doing the same thing, but I would say more than likely for a very different reason. Lot doesn't want them standing around or being outside at night in Sodom. It wasn't a very safe place. And I'm sure that he was very well aware of what this city was capable of, this city that he actually was a leader in right now. And he knew what was lurking in the shadows of that place, and he wanted them off the street very quickly. And let's keep reading. We'll find out exactly what that danger was, verses 4 to 11. It says, before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called out to Lot, where are the men who come to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them. Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him. And he said, now, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who've never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them. Don't do anything to these men, for they've come under the protection of my roof. Get out of our way, they replied. And they said, this fellow came here as an alien, and now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them. They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so that they could not find the door. All right, stop there. This town, you know, when we're talking about the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, we're not just talking about an open-mindedness about same-sex relationships or anything like that. We're not even talking about, you know, some of the things. We can look at some of the things that upset us or disturb us about, you know, cities. You think about San Francisco or whatever, and people always use that as an example and a joke and stuff. I have to tell you that we're still not to the stage that this town was in, because you got to look at the language here. We are talking about not just some sort of, you know, lax moral attitude about things, but it says that these guys, all of them, says all the men of this town, young and old, surrounded this house, surrounded this place, and their intention was to commit homosexual rape on these visitors who had come into their city. That is horrific. I mean, that is just, I mean, your mind actually shrinks away from even trying to, you know, you just don't even want it in your head. It's just so bad. But this is the depth to which the depravity of this town had fallen to. They'd lost all sensibilities of civilization behind them. This is primal. This is evil. This is unthinkable. And what's really amazing here is when, you know, you got Lot who goes outside, and you know the imagery there. He shuts the door behind him. He's trying to calm this down. He's trying to shield these guys. And he does something horrifying himself. He starts saying, well, here, you know, you can have my daughters. What is that? I mean, come on. That's just unbelievable. You can't even imagine. Now, part of it has to do with the Eastern hospitality concept there, the Middle Eastern hospitality, the rules of hospitality, in essence. I mean, when people had come in to be under the protection, he words it that way, the protection of your roof, it was even more shameful for him to allow harm to come to these visitors than it was for his own family to be violated. But I mean, you know, here he's offering his daughters out to these guys to do this, and it's just awful. This is no solution that he even offers to them. And as we see from this, as we read this account, we're getting a clue as to how far Lot's compromise has gone already. Because you notice in the languages, they're talking to him, you notice how this is fairly new all of a sudden, his conversation with them about this. He's challenging their wickedness. Now, he's a ruler in this city, or an elder in this city. Seated in the gate means that he's a respected elder in this city, and they're by and large supposed to be respectful of him. But we can see his compromise in his reaction to these guys and their reaction to him, because they weren't used to being corrected by him. You notice that as you read this? He's telling them, hey guys, don't do this. This is not right. And their response is, Lot, we've heard this a million times. We're sick of you preaching to us. No. They all of a sudden say, hey, look, you're a visitor here anyway. You came in as a sojourner. Now you're going to set yourself up as a judge over us? In other words, this is more than likely the first time that Lot, because he's pressed with his back to the wall, that Lot takes a stand. And he takes a stand for righteousness, and he stops and he says, no, this is not right. You guys can't do that. And all of a sudden, their respect for him as some sort of elder dissipates immediately. And they get angry with him because they don't want to hear his correction. They're angry because he's been going along with this, obviously, all along. He hasn't said anything. He may have been vexed in his spirit. That's what Peter said. He was perplexed and unhappy about it in his spirit, but clearly it wasn't making its way out in his comments. It wasn't making its way out in his taking a stand for anything. He'd never spoken about their sin before. So he's no longer treated like an elder of the city, but he's actually promised to be one of the first victims of this whole terrible night. You know, it's something that we've got to think about when we consider how we live our lives. It's real easy to just go right along with the flow of whatever the world is doing and whatever the values of our culture are. And we want to kind of be able to fit in. We want to get people's respect. And so we just flow along with whatever they do, and we don't say anything and we don't stop. We laugh at the jokes that come up that have a lot of sexual innuendo, or we go along with the flirtations. We do whatever we need to do to try to be respected and earn a place of respect among our peers. But I'll tell you what, it's a thin veneer if there is any respect there, because the moment we have to take a stand, the moment we have to stop and put the brakes on and say, hey, I can't go this way, I won't do this, I can't be a part of that, oh man, we'll kindle the ire of those who we've been placating up till then, and we won't have even as much respect from them as we would have had we taken a stand from the beginning. Because all of a sudden, they're like, well, who are you all of a sudden to sit here trying to judge us? So the angels grab a hold of Lot, and they pull him inside the door, and then they pull this cool Jedi mind trick on these guys. It says he blinds them, and I don't know that that means necessarily that they lose their sight altogether, because the language there is, it says they get tired of trying to find the door. I can't imagine that if they were completely blinded, they'd be still groping around for the door or whatever. I think that he tricked, you know, it was like, this isn't the house you're looking for. I think it was something along those lines where they just couldn't find the door anymore, you know. They forgot what a door looks like. And so they got burned out trying to find it or whatever. But however it worked, the angels supernaturally intervene here, and they disperse this crowd by their measures, and it's pretty cool. I really actually like that. How they do that. Well, let's keep reading here, because it keeps unfolding and it doesn't get any better. So Let's read verses 12 through 14. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anything, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we're going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against this people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry, get out of this place, because the Lord's about to destroy this city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. Now here we can see another example of Lot's compromise at this point, because obviously he was not influencing his family. He was not a godly influence to the point where when he comes with a message like this, they're saying, "Wow, you know, Lot, he's been telling us for a long time that there's wickedness in this place," or whatever. When he comes and tells them this radical message that things are about to end here, they think it's a joke. They think, "Oh, Lot, you're so funny. You're always pulling these little gags on us." What a terrible state to be in when you actually know and you really believe and you know what's going to be taking place, and no one's going to listen to you. No one's going to listen to him because he's compromised up to that point. And he hasn't been an influence so that he cannot convince them now concerning the warning of what's about to take place. You know, it's not like they had seen a change in his life. It's not like they'd seen him as any different, in other words, from everyone else in Sodom. Now, we know, as I said before, Peter refers to him as righteous. So the concept there is he is in the ranks of a believer. And yet his attitude and his lifestyle betray something else. He's compromised that. And they think that he's kidding when he comes to tell them. Now, you know, I went to my 20-year high school reunion, and when I walked up to the guys there and told them that I was a pastor, now they thought I was kidding. But and I really, really did. I had to get my little card that says I'm a pastor. I made it myself, but in crayon. But anyway, they thought I was kidding. But that's because they hadn't seen me for a long time. You know, I don't usually have that much trouble convincing someone that I'm a pastor around here. Well, sometimes, my kids. But anyway, let's keep reading here. Let's read verses 15 to 23. It says, "With the coming of the dawn, the angel urged Lot, saying, 'Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished.' When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters, and he led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, 'Flee for your lives. Don't look back. And don't stop anywhere on the plain. Flee to the mountains, or you will be swept away.' But Lot said to them, 'No, my lords, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you've shown great kindness to me in sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. Look, here's a town near enough to run to, and it's small. Let me flee to it. It's very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared.' He said to him, rolling his eyes, 'Very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it.' That's why the town is called Zoar, which means small." Okay, let's stop there. Now, I can understand, as I read this, you know, all of us, as we read this account, we can understand how the people of Sodom didn't believe. You know, they didn't want to leave the place. They had no confidence that anything was going to happen. And that's why even like his sons-in-law that were betrothed to his daughters weren't willing to get out of town or whatever. They didn't have any faith or confidence that this was any kind of a real threat. But does it boggle your mind at all that Lot, I mean, after all he's seen happen here, you know, he's got these two supernatural Jedi angels who've just gotten him out of a serious jam, and then the next day they're coming in saying, "Hey, you got to get out of here," and he's lingering, he's hanging out, he's hesitating. That's mind-boggling to me. What was he thinking? I mean, I've read a lot of different commentaries. I got to tell you, the only thing that makes any sense to me is that Lot had become so affectionate for the stuff that he had there in Sodom that it was very difficult for him to break away from it. You think about it. Lot had a bunch of stuff. He had a bunch of stuff before he got to Sodom. And clearly, when these angels were coming and telling him to get out, they weren't saying, grab your herds and your stuff, and get your suitcases all packed. They were grabbing him, saying, let's get out of here. And he was hesitating because he was looking at everything that he was going to have to leave behind. And I'll tell you, that's a terrible thing, because when we begin to compromise this way, when we start looking around to satisfy the desires of our heart with things other than the Lord, our affections can so quickly get wrapped up in the stuff of this world. Our affections and our loyalties can so quickly get corrupted. And it's hard to let go of things sometimes. Even when we know that it's not what God wants, even when we know that it could have a destructive end to it, it becomes difficult for us as human beings to actually unentangle ourselves from it. Whether it's a habit, whether it's something we own or possess, whether it's a relationship, we have this tendency to allow our loyalties to get attached to things other than God. And it's difficult. We hesitate, even when we know what's coming. We know what it'll do. And that's exactly what happened with Lot here, because he'd been living in compromise, because he'd been satisfying the desires of his heart, or trying to satisfy the desires of his heart with something other than God. When the call came out that this is just about over, this is about wrapping up, my friend, you need to get out, he hesitated. He waffled a little bit. Well, I just don't know. Can I leave all this behind? But you know what? It's cool because God's merciful to him. God doesn't just, the angels just don't throw up their hands and say, oh, well, I've had it with you. Come on, we got to get out of here. They grab him physically by the arms, grab him by the hands, the wrists, and yank him out of the town. Grab he and his wife and his daughters, and they physically pull them out of Sodom before the judgment comes. And that's an awesome thing, because he grabs a hold of Lot, free will and all, grabs a hold of him and drags him outside of the city, even though he had made other choices, even though he had made a determination of what he was going to do, even though he had already chosen to compromise the way he did, way back when he was standing on the hill with Abraham, looking out in different directions of where he was going to go. He'd made choices, but God's mercy intervened. And God, in his mercy, grabbed him by the wrist and yanked him out of town. God does that to us all the time. I'm telling you, he does. We find ourselves in situations time after time after time where we've gone ahead and allowed our affections and our loyalties to transfer to something else, some lesser lover than God. And when God knows it's going to be destructive for us, there are so many times in our histories that we can look back and realize that, well, we thought everything was going stupid, but in actuality, it was God grabbing us by the wrist and yanking us out of something. All of a sudden, some relationship goes south, or our attempts at gaining this or that fall apart. And at first, we're all distressed, and we're upset, and we're unhappy when nothing goes my way, blah, blah, blah. When in actuality, we don't see it, but it's the unseen hand of God grabbing us by the wrist and yanking us out of harm's way, because he loves us that much. Because he's faithful to us that way. So he, in his mercy, grabs a hold of Lot and his family, and he gets him outside there. And it's an amazing exchange that takes place here to me. I just think this is amazing. The angels tell Lot and his kinfolk to move away from there. No. Anyway, he tells them to go head for the hills, and Lot, this is amazing to me. Lot sits there arguing with him, saying, well, do I have to go that far? Couldn't we go over here? And he starts pleading the case for this town of Zoar. You remember that just in the last chapter, Abraham is standing there with the angel of the Lord, and he is pleading the case for Sodom. He's pleading the case for you, and you see what these guys were like. I mean, we're talking about, worse than any prison you can probably even think of. But I mean, just a terrible mess of people, and he is there pleading their case, saying, Lord, if you can find 10 righteous there, will you spare the whole place? Will you save this city? This is a big city. Will you save them if we can have 10 that are righteous? He's got a compassion and a heart for these people, and he's got no self-interest involved in this at all. He's just looking at it, and he's thinking of the humanity of it, and I'm sure his mind was drifting to specifics of people that he knew, and he was throwing his life there in front of the Lord, saying, please, please spare them. And the contrast between Abraham, what he's doing, and Lot is there absolutely out of convenience sake. He's pleading the case for Zoar, but not so that he'll spare Zoar, but just so that he doesn't have to go as far. Because it's a lot more convenient for him, because I can't go all the way to the hills. Lord, I'm tired. I got to rest here. Good grief. Up in the hills? There's a town right here. Let me stay there. Just preserve them. They're not bad people anyway, right? There's a small town. Let me go there. I'm telling you, this is so American Christianity that I can't even get over it. Because this is what we're all about, man. Convenience. Oh God, let your kingdom come. Let your kingdom come, but don't mess up my hair in the process. Make sure that I get it my way and things are working well for me and it's very convenient. But Lord, let your kingdom be established. Just don't mess up my courts. Don't mess my stuff up. And that is exactly what we're like. That's exactly the kind of compromised Christianity we, for the most part, have to be honest that we live here in the United States. We want God's will. We want Him to do stuff. But as long as it's convenient for us and we don't have to go all the way up to the hills, couldn't you just bless the little stuff that's going on around here or whatever? Lot was compromising from beginning to end. And even his attempt at trying to get favor for some town was based in self-interest. There was no sacrifice. We said that before when we were studying the book of Romans, that there is no true love without sacrifice. There's no true sacrifice without there being a motive of love. And Lot is missing all of that in his interchange here with the Lord, his exchange of ideas here with the angel. So he's pleading for Zoar so that it can be convenient for him. And of course, the Lord is merciful, as He's merciful with us, and He allows it. And there's probably a whole lesson in that, but I won't go into it. But let's keep reading here, verses 24 to 29. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. You know what? Before we go on any further, let me just stop right there, because you need to, if you underline stuff in your Bible, that's a cool thing to underline. Look how that's worded there. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. You're wanting some sort of proof text? You're wanting something that points towards a plurality in the Godhead more than, He is one living God, but He is in three distinct essences. Or one essence, three distinct substances. So one substance, three distinct... How does it go? Hypostases and... Either way, I'll go back in my theology notebook and remember what that is. But the concept is, He is three in one. He is the Trinity. And here we have God Himself in two distinct places, here on earth and in heaven. The Lord rained down sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord in heaven. So anyway, I just thought I'd point that out. Verse 25. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation of the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land, like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, He remembered Abraham, and He brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. You realize that for many, many years, actually up until just recently, these cities, the five cities of this plain, were considered to be mythological. They said, well, there's no evidence of that, you know, because people are so smart. That Sodom was just a mythical place. There was no Sodom. There was no. This is all allegory. Nothing like this could ever happen. 1973, archaeologists excavating in the southeast part of the Dead Sea found the remains of five distinct cities around there. One of them being the largest, a fortified city in that area. And in that on the edges of that fortified city, and I forget the name, it's an Arabic name, I forgot, I didn't write it down. But anyway, in that area there is a graveyard, a burial area with buildings that were used for tombs that is largely intact, that they've been able to excavate. They said the whole area around there has suffered terrible burn damage. There's an entire layer of ash, of, you know, an ash layer, sometimes as thick as 3 feet, covering the entire area where these ruins are. The most intact buildings are these burial buildings, these graves. And all of the archaeological evidence points to the fact that these were burned as well. But what was significant about them is that they burned not from within, starting from a floor or a wall, but they burned from the roof inward. In other words, there's signs of collapsed roofs in on the ruins that are there. And they puzzled over it for a while, and then they found in actuality that there are large deposits of bitumen underneath the surface of the soil there, which is it's like an asphalt kind of stuff. It's highly flammable, and there's also evidence of earthquake activity. In fact, this the ruins of that larger fortified city was lying right on a fault line. I believe that it's very possible God used these. Anyway, the bottom line is the scholars now are saying, hey, this actually looks like this is the remains of Sodom and these other five cities that are mentioned here in the Bible. So, oops, we were wrong. I guess they were there. And the archaeological evidence points to a catastrophe wiping that place out. The archaeological evidence of that entire basin area shows that at one time it was a very rich and fertile plain. And because of whatever disaster took place from that point on, we know now it's the Dead Sea. You go down there now, it's salt flats and things like that. I mean, it's a completely barren moonscape type of area. So the evidence is there. I believe that it's very possible that, you know, the fact that this bitumen, it's a petroleum-based kind of tar pit type stuff, if it were flammable and caught fire, it could have been raining down like raining down flaming sulfur on a city or whatever. It doesn't negate the fact that this was still God's hand that did it, even if it was, you know, natural things that he used to bring about this judgment. It could be, it'd have been a supernatural firestorm as well. I'm not discounting that. But the fact that there's archaeological evidence, even geological evidence, to indicate that something like this is quite possible. The fact that it says Abraham, when he went out and looked at it and saw thick, dense smoke, speaks of a petroleum-type fire, because that's the kind of, you know, that thick, dark smoke is usually associated with that. So that there's a lot of things that go along with it. Anyway, bottom line is, scholars now have gone ahead and given their seal of approval to the Bible on this level here anyway, and say that that this more than likely did happen, though of course they don't assign this to being God. It was just an explanation of some terrible event that happened, a natural calamity. Aliens, yeah, they'll go for aliens, but never God. So anyway, we see in this story that as they leave the area where this catastrophe is happening, the judgment's coming down, that Mrs. Lot stops, and she's obviously at the end of the column that's heading out of town, stops and turns around and looks back, and it says that she's turned into a pillar of salt. I have no explanation for that other than that God just did it. You know, there's no, you're not going to find any kind of scientific support for something like that. I don't need it. I believe what the Word says. You know, the Lord just worked that out. The fact of the matter is, what we see in that is that even though she was physically leaving this city, even though she was physically heading out, her heart was still attached and still so identified with what was taking place in Sodom that she, as the angels warned, was swept away with the same judgment that came down because she was too closely associated with what had been there. You see, that's the whole concept of God's judgment on sin. You know, we talk about that. God's judgment is being revealed, His wrath is being revealed already against sin. It's not that God is out of control, angry at people or anything like that, but God views sin like a mother of a child would view a cancer that was destroying their child. God views sin that same way. This is something that eats away and destroys His beautiful creation. It's something that produces death. He hates that stuff. He hates it. And when we as human beings have associated with that and identified with that, you know, before our before our salvation experience, before the new birth, and our hearts were dead in sin and locked in step with sin, then that judgment that God pours out against sin is poured out on human beings as well, because they're so identified with sin, because they're identified with the object of His wrath. And that's the concept here that we see happening with Mrs. Lot. She's still associated, she's still connected, she's still identified with the object of His wrath, and she gets swept away in the judgment as well. And it's interesting, we don't know her name. We never do learn her name. She's Mrs. Lot, for all we know. And Jesus in Luke 17:32, as He was warning about the things of the end of the age, says, remember Lot's wife. She makes it an appearance in the New Testament that way. But as a warning, remember what happened to her. Don't allow our affections to get transferred to this world which is passing away. Don't allow ourselves to look back and gaze longingly for what we've left behind in following Jesus. Because her fate could befall us if we do. We don't ever know her name, but she still stands as a reminder of what can happen if we allow ourselves to develop loyalties in a world, to a world that's passing away. Well, let's finish up this really happy story with verses 30 through 38. So Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. One day the older daughter said to the younger, our father is old and there's no man around here to lie with us, as is the custom all over the earth. Let's get our father to drink wine and then lie with him and preserve our family line through our father. That night they got their father to drink wine and the older daughter went in and lay with him. He wasn't aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. The next day the older daughter said to the younger, last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight and you go in and lie with him so we can preserve our family line through our father. So they got their father to drink wine that night also, and the younger daughter went in and lay with him again. Again, he was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. So both Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab, and he is the father of the Moabites today. The younger daughter also had a son and named him Ben-Ammi, and he is the father of the Ammonites of today. So here is the final tragic postscript to this life of compromise that Lot has been leading here. And this is what compromise has brought to him. He's lost his wife, he's lost his possessions, he's lost his home, and now he's lost a moral compass for his daughters, for his children. This is a very creepy development here. This is obviously, this is not something that was an accepted custom of that time or anything like that. Clearly, you know, their plan that they hatched is to get him drunk, because he wouldn't have gone with it had he been of a sober mind at that time. But they leave Zoar. I think that's interesting. You know, he pled to be able to stay in Zoar so he didn't have to go so far away, and then all of a sudden he's afraid, it says. I'm assuming he is afraid because he's worried that the same kind of judgment is going to come to Zoar. He's probably looking around and realizing these people are still pretty wicked. You know, this isn't safe here either. And so he says, come on, we're going to head to the hills. And he goes and hides in a cave. This guy is about extremism at this point. And you know what? I'll tell you, that is so often the case with people, though. We see where we've compromised, we see where we've fallen short, and instead of just getting on track with our relationship with God and finding out what He wants for our lives or whatever, we head out to some extremism. And so here they are, He's leading them out there to live in a cave, and of course that causes this dissatisfaction with his daughters. They feel left out. They feel like, you know, they say, you know, the custom in the whole world is for people to be able to pair up. And so they come up with this very flimsy excuse to do this terribly, terribly perverse thing of sleeping incestually with their own father. And it's interesting because as we look at that, you know, you see what compromise has led to. And because this is not a man who's influenced his family, he hasn't influenced his children towards righteousness, towards the character of God. He can take them out of Sodom, but he can't get the Sodom out of them. He can't remove that 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 influence that Sodom had on them. And clearly that sort of thing was probably acceptable in that city, but the end of that city was terrible. But he's out there in this cave, and they want what they want, and they make their determination as to how they're going to get it. And again, we see there's another good example of drinking too much, of excessive drinking leading to something shameful. We have yet to see any example from the Bible at all of overindulgence with alcohol leading to anything positive. It's always shameful. It's always terrible. And here's another case where a terrible thing happens as a result of it. Lot, instead of being a strong leader for his family and instructing his daughters in righteousness and letting them know and leading them towards an understanding of why this terrible stuff has happened and why they're out in a cave in the middle of nowhere now, he starts drinking. And he just tries to drown the whole thing. He does what so many men do, and that's hide. Instead of dealing with the battle at hand, he hides away. And when he hides away, his daughters take control, and with no moral compass, sin is the resulting thing. And so the product of this incestual relationship are these two sons, the father of the Moabites and the father of the Ammonites, and they are a thorn in the side of Israel from that point on. Not so much in any kind of oppressive way, but because they are always introducing false religion into Israel. The practice of Molech worship comes through them. The practice of Baal worship comes through these people that were the result of this incestual and sinful relationship. So it's a tragic thing. We look at this and you could get kind of, you know, bummed out. You feel bad for Lot. His lot is not good. And we see from it, what we take from this, what we realize is that no matter what, there is a price to pay for compromise. And it's not some sort of legalistic thing. It's not something that's got to be worked out in our good performance or anything like that. It's all about loyalties. It all comes down to what we center as the satisfaction of our heart's desire. When we look to other things, when we go along with this world, when we try to find respect here, when we try to find our pot of gold, so to speak, in this life, in this world, a world that's passing away, the end result's not good. We know from Peter that he's referred to as righteous Lot. We have some sense of affirmation that he is in the kingdom. But oh, what a price to pay through all of that. The loss of his wife, the corruption of his children. How much better it would be to be like Abraham. You see, you think about this. Think about this for a minute. Lot lived in a city, and then he lived in a cave. Two very permanent type of dwelling places. Two dwelling places that were in the extremes. One of them caught up in the values and the concept of a fallen world, and one of them off out there in the wilderness somewhere trying to be a hermit. But permanent type dwelling places, and neither one of them as satisfactory places for a person of faith to live. Look at the contrast of that and Abraham. Abraham, through all of this, lives in a tent. He never builds a city. He never sets down his roots. He recognizes, he lives and partakes of the world that's there before him, but he never identifies with it to the point where his desires are locked on this place. He's a pilgrim passing through the entire story, and we read about it even in Hebrews, that they were looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. Nothing on this earth was going to ever satisfy Abraham. He was camping. He was a pilgrim heading towards something else. Had Lot learned that lesson, things would have gone differently for him. But instead, he tried to find the satisfaction of his desires in things here. And he set down roots in places here. He homesteaded right on top of a bullseye where God's judgment was coming. So it's a lesson to be learned and something to take to heart. Right on? We should all get motorhomes, absolutely. And I'm leading the caravan. I'm kidding. Well, let's pray, and then we can take questions if anyone wants to. Father, we thank you for your word, Lord. I just pray that we can take this to heart. Father, I look at this, and I've contemplated this passage, and I pray, Father, that we don't walk away with a sense of condemnation, but a hope and a sense of encouragement that there is a satisfaction for our desires, but it just doesn't come here. It comes through relationship with you, and I pray that you'll lead us towards that. Help us to follow Abraham's example, to never homestead here, to never take this as our identity, but that we recognize we belong to you, we were made for you. Our meaning and our purpose is derived from our identification in you. I just pray that you work that in our hearts and lead us that way. Help us not to live a life of compromise. Help us not to pay that kind of price. But establish us, Lord, in your love and lead us towards your kingdom. And I just pray that for us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.